I'm delighted now to welcome Gay Dillingham. She's director and producer of the documentary Dying to Know, Ram Dass and Timothy Leary. The film is narrated by Robert Redford, and it will screen this Thursday, that's tomorrow, at 7 o'clock at the Lenzic Center for Performing Arts here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Charlotte, and thank you for being such a big, beautiful part of our community.
Well, thank you. Thank you for being here and for making this wild and crazy and beautifully made, I have to say, beautifully made and crafted and edited film. So Timothy Leary and Ram Dass, in a way, it's like a portrait of a decades-long friendship between these two men who were very close and then fell apart and came back together. Tell us a little bit about each of them. Some of our listeners will know both of them intimately. Some will have never heard of them.
Right. Someone the other day said, whether you've heard of them or not, they've changed your life.
Interesting.
Which I realized is a big statement, but fairly true. Well, I did not live through the 60s. So when I met Timothy Leary and Ram Dass, it was a fairly spontaneous moment. It was 1995, and Timothy had just announced he was dying in the media. And I was having dinner with my then-not-yet husband and another couple who were in the business in Los Angeles, filmmaking. And we said, what could we do? This is a historical moment. So my husband Andrew was the one that came up with the idea, let's bring Ram Dass down and put them in dialogue together, which was the real brilliant idea. That because I didn't understand their relationship at that point. And the film, over 19 years, has become, that is the portal of the film, is their relationship, because I really feel like most of life happens in teams and in relationship. And I had only understood these men as caricatures, what my media culture had handed me, and particularly Leary, glorified and demonized. And the man I met on his deathbed was so different. He was interesting, curious, charismatic, intelligent, vulnerable, human. And to be able to see him through the lens of Ram Dass, through Richard Alpert, was really eye-opening, because it was through the lens of love that you could see a man. And so that's the human story we're telling. And these two men, just to give you some background, are the two Harvard psychologists in the early 60s that were probing the edges of consciousness, doing sanctioned experiments with graduate students with psilocybin. Psychedelic or psychoactive mushrooms. And Richard was then fired in 63. Leary actually was never fired. His contract ran out. But that's kind of what exploded the 60s in large part in terms of, it got out. All the psychedelic movement really did get out in other ways. But I found it fascinating that Timothy Leary was almost single-handedly blamed. And I find scapegoating a very dangerous thing in our society. So I started digging into the research and the archival material. And in many ways, this journey was very personal for me. And I, the more I learned, the more curious I got. And there's 80 years of footage in this film from the very beginning to the very end, from 16-millimeter footage all the way through digital to 2013.
Timothy Leary and Ram Dass, if they hadn't left Harvard, and I think it's an interesting side note that the person responsible for getting Richard Alpert, later Ram Dass, fired was the now famous Dr. Andrew Weil, who was an undergraduate at that time. That's a little piece of history that I didn't know.
Indeed. Most people didn't, including myself. It actually took us years to figure that out. And ironically, I was also, with my husband, co-producing the first two PBS shows for Andrew Weil in the mid-90s and didn't know this.
Right.
So that actually even helped launch his career. So fast forward, Andrew Weil was an undergraduate, and he was on the Harvard Crimson newspaper. And at that point, the administration was really feeling this was getting out of control, and they needed a reason to get rid of these guys. And so Andrew Weil did an investigative report that then led to the firing of Richard Alpert, because Richard had, well, I don't want to go too far because it's in the story, but
Well, he'd given LSD to an undergraduate, which was against the rules because it was only for graduate students.
Yes, actually, it might not. It was a psychedelic, and I'm not sure.
Oh, okay, one of the psychedelics, right.
And it was, right, it was off campus on a holiday, but he wasn't. That was not part of the agreement with the administration.
So if these two guys...
And guess who it was? The person was Ronnie Winston, which is the Harry Winston diamond fortune. So what ended up happening, which is all these details are not in there, that's why I'm going to tell you, because it's a little bit of a side interesting story. So Ronnie Winston was pulled into the administration and said, we won't give you your diploma unless you turn in Richard Alpert. And his father said, you're not going to get your inheritance, which at that point was hundreds of millions of dollars. So you can see why he made the choice he did.
Oh, my goodness. Crazy. It's like, all right. So I guess the thing that I keep noticing or thinking about is if these two men had remained Harvard professors, the 60s could have gone a very different way, because once freed from that academic environment, especially Timothy Leary went into kind of full-on mode of promoting this type of exploration of consciousness, which the society was so ripe to embrace at that point after World War II and the 1950s and the Cold War and all of these sort of constricting influences on American society.
That's a good point. Well, what was fascinating to me is to see the arc of Timothy's, really his beliefs and the way he played them out. He started out pretty conservative. I found a lot of footage from these Senate hearings in the mid-60s. And he was saying, you know, this should be licensed. People need to have physical, mental, emotional criteria met. This is a medical issue, not a criminal issue. So he was really, you know, I think as Joanna Harcourt Smith, who's in the film, says, that's really when his rebel side came out, because he was arrested for less than half an ounce of grass and sentenced to 35 years in prison. And in many ways, he might have been one, if not the first, one of the first casualties of this drug war. And he went from being pretty prudent and conservative to, after he was arrested twice and put in prison, took his own test, because he designed the test, the intake test in the California prison system.
Right. That is a very funny little, another little funny aside. He designed psychological evaluation tests and then took his own test, which he pretty much probably knew how to answer.
Exactly. So he got admitted to a low security prison because of that. And that's how he was able to escape with the aid of the Weather Underground and the Black Panthers. So then you know, I don't want to give away too much of the story. Many of us know kind of what happened at that point, but that's kind of when he got more radicalized. And many people that think they know who Timothy Leary is, it's those later years when he really was more, very much a social revolutionary, and pretty angry at the system in many ways, but kept a smile on his face.
Well, I think that the themes of freedom and imprisonment, especially in his life, kind of run throughout the film, because this whole idea of drugs as a pathway to a certain kind of inner freedom and breaking down ego and things like that. And then he was actually in prison, and then he escaped, but was then kind of imprisoned in different ways, and then ended up in witness protection programs. And it really, I mean, a crazy roller coaster of a life. And you find yourself, or I found myself, reflecting on, you know, when is a person most free?
He thought a lot about that. Think for yourself was one of his main mottos. Most people don't remember that he actually spent almost 4 years in prison.
Yeah.
And 2.5 of those were in solitary confinement. That's a big deal.
Yeah. Do you think that his explorations into consciousness and all of that helped him get through the solitary confinement?
Definitely. Definitely. Yeah. He has a fascinating biography, autobiography, Flashbacks. And so I learned a lot more in that. All manner of things. They put him next to Charles Manson, trying to kind of break him down in solitary confinement.
Oh, my goodness. So it wasn't entirely solitary.
Well, I mean, you're in solitary confinement, but you know who's next, and you can hear people, and they talk to each other.
Uh-huh.
So that's not in our film.
Right.
But there's we packed a lot of story into 90 minutes.
I know. It must have been crazy to try to figure out what you could leave out.
Right. And I just want to do a shout-out because this hometown screening is really going to be sweet for me to be able to thank. You can imagine over 18, 19 years, there's a lot of Santa fans that have intersected this story and this film in terms of getting it done. So I want to also thank David Leach, who is a brilliant editor and is Santa Fean and great storyteller, and obviously couldn't have done it without him, and some other Santa Fe people that I get to thank tomorrow night.
Yeah, excellent. Now, there's another set of themes, and it's implied in the title, Dying to Know, this theme of death and this theme of the importance of death as a kind of direction, inevitable direction in all of our lives, and how much we embrace it and how much we choose not to think about it.
Mm-hmm. I did dedicate this film to Matt and Tom Dillingham, and that's my brother and my father. And my brother died in an automobile accident when I was 17. He was 20, and he was wonderful, spirit, center of my world. So it really kind of brought me to my knees early in my life and helped me start, kind of demanded that I start waking up because I felt like I didn't have any choice. But I had a particular relationship with death at that moment because I realized it can be an opportunity. And the film starts with a Carl Jung quote, which is, "I behold death, for it teaches me how to live." And because I then had this lens early in my life, you know, I saw that not all cultures are like ours. Others embrace, have ritualistic ways of dealing with the fact we're mortal. We have a life and a death. We're in a cycle of nature. And I found the older I got, the more detrimental this taboo that we are not very good at dealing with has really held us back. I mean, I think it keeps us from dealing with some of the bigger issues in our life. I spent many years dealing with climate change, nuclear weapons. These are the things that I think if we just understood and were more, I guess, free and honest about our mortality, then we would potentially have a better, more healthy relationship with some of these big tasks in front of us. So that's a little esoteric, but it's meaningful to me. The death door, for me also, Lirian Alpert wrote a book back in the 60s called The Psychedelic Experience, which was based on the Tibetan Book of the Dead. So when people were in a psychedelic session, they would go through these, you know, processes, these bardos. And in many ways, it's practicing ego death. So I always kind of associated that if done consciously, the psychedelic practice with practicing ego death. So that's also why Timothy, the first person he called when he found out that he was dying was Ram Dass. And that's when they really reconnected. And he knew, because Ram Dass had a very long career since their time at Harvard with midwifing the dying and the grieving process. And he started many, you know, foundations that were based on spiritual activism, and also he started the Dying Project with Stephen Levine and Andrea and Stephen Levine.
It's interesting too, and maybe you can speak to this better than I can, but I always wonder, especially when I behold people like Ram Dass and Timothy Leary. On the one hand, they're talking about ego death and they're practicing these things like meditation and the drug experiences, and as Ram Dass says, the drug experiences are kind of, they come and go, and the awakenings that you get really don't last, whereas the practice of spirituality has more of a deeper lasting effect on the human psyche. But they're doing this stuff, and they're doing it very much in public, and when you're in the public eye, it's really hard not to cultivate ego, because that's kind of what the process forces on mm-hmm, you. Mm-hmm. And so like negotiating the difference between, on the one hand, that kind of humility that comes with ego death, and on the other hand, being really both of them kind of celebrities.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting point. Ram Dass, I think, has practiced, even though he's very loved and followed by, you know, he's still alive and lives in Maui and is a teacher for hundreds of thousands that follow him, even in cyberspace. And he's practiced so long that I think he is really living in a state of unconditional love now. Timothy was more of ego. And the first time I ever saw him was just a, you know, when I was in college in the 80s, it was post-prison for him. And I really saw the showman, not the man. So I wasn't actually very attracted to who he was back then. But I was on his deathbed because he was so vulnerable and so honest. And I think I'm answering your question, which is, yeah, no matter what, if you're put in that limelight, it's very difficult to not, you know, take yourself so seriously, I suppose. But these two were so funny. I mean, I think this film really brings out the humor in both of them because it might sound depressing because it's also about death, but a young girl, when I showed it to the class over at University of Art and Design, a Spanish girl who was only 18, so she didn't have the cultural context or the age, and at the end she said, "This film makes me want to live more and love more." So the feedback I'm getting is it's really inspirational, and that means a lot to me because that's it was to me too. That's why I kept working this film, thinking, you know, there's something so profound here that I'm learning, but I don't know if it's going to be meaningful to anyone else. So the fact so far it's doing really well is a real blessing.
Yeah, well, that's something I wanted to ask you about. I mean, we're talking to Gay Dillingham about the film Dying to Know Ram Dass and Timothy Leary, which, by the way, screens tomorrow, Thursday, at 7 o'clock at the Lensic Performing Arts Center. I wondered what the process was like of making the film and how it affected you.
Well, yeah, I it's coming on 19 years now, so I don't recommend it as a business model.
However, did you know for 19 years? I mean, 19 years ago you thought, I'm going to
no
make
clue.
A film. You've been working on it ever since?
Well, not straight. I mean, obviously, I set it down for many, many years and launched an environmental technology business with my husband, have two factories here in New Mexico, and did 8 years of environmental management for the state. So the way it worked was end of 95 and 96, I worked on it and got a lot of the footage and then set it down and went back to Ram Dass, then had his stroke. So I got this narrow window of interview with him after Tim had died and before his stroke, which was severe. He only had 10% chance of survival. And then I set it down because he needed to recover. My dad died, business, a lot of things took my attention. And I went back and interviewed him once in 2003 and then set it down again. So I just kind of keep tuning back into it and looking at the footage and working it and then really went back in more full-time after I was asked to leave my public service from the Environmental Improvement Board in the end of 2010 and really put full-time into it like 2011 and 12 and 13, I guess. Not full-time, but really concentrated on it because a film like this takes that amount of time. You can't, make a film part-time. And I was really kind of beating myself up there for a while thinking because I hadn't finished it, tried to hand it off, told Ram Dass, I got to hand this off. And he finally looks at me and says, "You'll finish it one day." So it's a better film because it took me so long. It's a much wider arc of history, and you see more of who Ram Dass really is, which I couldn't have gotten if I would have finished it any earlier.
Right.
So I would tell other filmmakers, you know, if you have something that's really digging deep in you, do what you can. Even if you don't know when and how it's going to get finished. And I also have to really thank Bob Redford because he was the first outsider that wasn't my mother or my friends who I asked to watch it, and that was 2012. And he and his wife, Billy, watched it, and he called me the next day and went on for like 10 or 15 minutes. He really understood the story. He said he loved it. It was a great film. And it really put the wind in my sails to finish it. I spontaneously at that moment also asked him to narrate it, which he said he would be honored to do. But more than his narration, I would say his guidance as a master storyteller. He gave me his feedback on the phone sessions, and then he sat with me with his notes. And, you know, I was embarrassed to say, but I was a little defensive, thinking, maybe he doesn't know exactly what I'm doing here. But, of course, he's a master storyteller, and 95% of what he said I was able to execute on, I agreed with, and it helped make a much better film. So just another shout out, thank you, eternally grateful to him for that guidance.
And in terms of your own. I mean, when you said with a film like this, you don't know exactly when it's going to end. I mean, it's like mm-hmm. life itself. You don't know when your life is going to end either. Mm-hmm. And yet there's a natural process and a kind mm-hmm. of an unfolding to all of this. And then now the film is done. Now you're bringing it to various communities. Have a lot of people seen it yet? Where did it premiere?
Well, I would like to say that my big goal was to be able to finish it while Ram Dass was alive. And so our first screening was a benefit for him this summer in Maui. And great audience, standing ovation, you know, he loved it. I think I spent the entire film watching him watch it. And so that was our first public experience, which was very good. And then it actually premiered at the Mill Valley Film Festival just last month. And there was three showings, and they were all sold out before this festival even started. So that was very exciting. Of course, that's a somewhat, you know, primed audience. And then did something called the Awakened World Film Festival also last month. And what was really interesting about that, which is unique for any filmmaker, is they chose 20 films. It's a new festival. It was their first year. And they gave each film 3 hours. So you show the film, and there's a kind of a moderator. In my case, it was this beautiful Detroit reverend of this very unique church who helped lead ours. And we had a really deep dive as an audience, you know, and had the time to really dive into what comes up in this film, because my goal was to start a conversation. And that's what happens. So that's why I've shown. So Santa Fe is really, you know, one of our first screenings, and I wanted to do it here before. I'm in the process of learning a lot about distribution and what partners and distribution companies and how to really put it into the world. And good news, obviously, for me is it's not, it doesn't have an expiration date on it. And in many ways, the longer I've waited, the more we've met the kind of cultural zeitgeist, because I think people are more interested in these things now than they were, say, 5 or 10 years ago. Death, drugs.
Interesting.
And a lot of the research is coming back with psychedelics and dying, and psychedelics with working on addictions.
So I think one of the things that I like about it and that's important about it is it does give a portrait of the 60s in a lot of ways without being nostalgic for it. And I think there's a kind of, I mean, I don't know about anybody else, but I'm personally sick to death of anything that promotes a kind of nostalgia for the 60s, because it's so over in so many ways, and it needs to be over. But as you say, there's some essential parts of it that do come back around.
Mm-hmm. Perennial
human issues that are not really about nostalgia, but are about deeper things than that.
Right. What did the 60s start to evoke and evolve that in some ways was suppressed, but it came into our culture, and it is, you know, there is a new cycle coming around, I think. You know, I also want to say that I'm realizing I didn't make a film that a baby boomer, for instance, would have made. I'm somewhere between the boomers and the millennials.
I think that's called Generation X.
Generation X, though, that's what I am then, I guess. And it means a lot to me that people that lived through the 60s, and even with these guys, say how much they've learned and how, you know, they really like this film, finally telling the story of the 60s. But then young kids that have no clue who these guys are also really engaged in it. I just have to figure out how to market to them. But so far, it's reaching a wide age group, and I think because I wasn't trying to prove anything so much as I was curious, and I just was able to follow that curiosity. And in many ways, I grew up with the film, too, you know.
Right, right.
I was young when I started it.
Exactly. Very interesting. Well, Gay Dillingham is the director and producer of the documentary Dying to Know, Ram Dass and Timothy Leary. It's narrated by Robert Redford. It will screen tomorrow, Thursday, at 7 o'clock at the Lenzik Center for Performing Arts. For tickets, you can call 988-1234 or go to ticketsantafe.org. And the screening is a benefit for three organizations?
Yes, UPAYA, Zen Center. And I'd like to say Roshi Joan Halifax is also in the film. She plays a very important part, which please come and see for yourself. So UPAYA and Joan have done a lot of interesting work training caregivers, doctors, nurses in end-of-life care, not just treating the body but the soul. And I chose these three groups because they basically intersect the themes in the film. And the second group is Drug Policy Alliance, which is both a New Mexico group and a national group, looking at more sane drug policies. And the third group is CCA, Independent Filmmaking, and Jason over at CCA has been very helpful.
Excellent.
So I'm very excited to be doing this for these groups. And the other person in the film is Joanna Harcourt Smith, who's a local.
Right. Well, everybody can see all of them tomorrow night at the Lens at Gay Dillingham. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.